You're listening to Asheville FM and the Asheville FM News Hour. I'm news team correspondent KP Whaley. And today we're taking a further look into the LGBT health survey put out by the Campaign for Southern Equality. Last week we did an overview, and this week we're going to drill down a little bit further into a couple of sections within in the report. Joining me in studio is Ivy Hill, the Community Health Program Director. Ivy, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Also joining us in studio is Winston Sanders, New Southern Leaders Fellow. And Winston, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
So today we kind of wanted to talk through a couple of the sections within the report, mostly those in sections 1 and 2 dealing with the physical health and then the mental health after that. And so one of the things that I found very interesting in this report is that generally LGBTQ Southerners are feeling pretty comfortable and in terms of their physical health being okay. What's the terms that you used? Fair and good to excellent. But there are some disparities when it comes to different segments of our population, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, there's a pretty significant jump when it comes to trans-identified folks. Do you want to talk or speak to that?
Sure. So when we look at the general LGBT population, we see that about 30% of our respondents rated their health as either fair or poor. When we look specifically at the trans community, we see that number jump up to 40%, mm-hmm. which is a pretty significant jump. And then we see another jump again when we look specifically at non-binary folks.
So what do you think are some of the reasons behind that? And I know you both also work in Gender Benders, an organization in upstate South Carolina. Mm-hmm. And you've worked on the last year's health report specifically for trans folks.
Yeah. So another piece of research that the Campaign for Southern Equality did last year, we published the 2018 Trans Health Focus Group Project Report. So as part of that, we traveled the South and talked to 50 different trans folks from different areas about the barriers that we face in accessing healthcare. So some of that may also be helpful to talk about in this conversation.
Yeah, let's get into that.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of different reasons why we see that come up. And we know that there are disparities across the board for the LGBT community, but I think there are some reasons why we see that more pronounced in the trans community. There's stuff like when you're in the waiting room or dealing with front office staff and somebody's going to call you back, your sexual orientation isn't actually part of that conversation. It's not interwoven throughout the entire interactions with everybody on staff, but your gender identity is. So we heard stories about people like being called by the wrong name, the wrong pronouns, that sort of stuff. And especially if you're from a small rural town in the South, that kind of outing you can put you in a really dangerous situation. Mm. And so having some of those experiences, having friends who have had some of those experiences, I think make us a lot less likely to go to the doctor. And we carry a lot of that trauma and stuff with us when we go into the space anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And also with that, just finding a doctor who is probably inclusive and welcoming isn't that easy as well.
Yeah, totally. So there's another resource that Winston and I both work on with the Campaign for Southern Equality called the Trans in the South Guide. And so that was something that I started. I think this was our fourth version that we just published, and we'll be publishing another update of it soon. But it's more than doubled over the time that we've been putting that guide out. It lists trans-friendly medical providers and attorneys and other resources like that across the South. And there's 13 southern states that are included there, and now there are more than 400 providers that are included. But that's across 13 southern states. So when you think about how many providers there are on the whole, that's still a pretty small percentage of them that are trans-friendly.
Right. I mean, even just finding a resource like that would be very eye-opening and welcoming if you go to a community. But those kinds of resources aren't, you know, widely available, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it's getting better. I think in every town across the South, there are providers who want to treat trans folks, mm-hmm. but there are also some barriers there. Like, you don't get the level of education that you need. You don't get the cultural competency trainings that you need in school. So the providers that we find that are the really trans-friendly ones who are doing this work for our folks are people who have had to seek out that education themselves.
Mm-hmm.
We find that a lot in the rural areas versus urban areas, that it is, you know, more of a task to find a quality of care. And that speaks volumes, that great that we have the Trends in the South guide, but like to Ivy speaking about the medical providers not being able to access more competent training on that, that still is a barrier that we see even in the rural areas. And I was raised in a rural area, mid-rural, like 30,000 people. So the experience of that, in not even with trans folks, but just with folks that live in that rural area, of competent medical providers coming in and lasting about maybe 5 years max, and they leave and go somewhere else. And that's a disparity all the way around. I know it's not, you know, just particularly inclusive of trans folks, but I definitely want to point that out as something as well, for folks to know that it's just, even though we are specifically talking about trans and gender nonconforming folks, it is still all around thing in the rural areas versus urban areas to find this competent quality of care, to live a long and prosperous and healthful life.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because you know, we talk about gaps in education and in other areas within our community as well, especially when it comes to people of color, and and that's an issue there as well. It's just attracting quality educators that are looking like me versus looking like the the majority. Is difficult, and keeping those folks here in the rural areas, and Asheville certainly isn't rural by these standards, but it is rural by the standards of large cities around the country. So is there anything we can do to improve that? That's an interesting point that you brought up, and I'm just wondering what can be done to keep quality people who are in healthcare in smaller communities.
I would say that maybe even the pay gap, I mean, is a thing. And especially if we're talking about in the kind of binary sense of like men versus women. And also just, I think that that's a big thing, is probably pay. And, you know, kind of having things in the area, in that rural area, that would kind of keep them there. You know, just like where I'm from, we used to have a movie theater, we used to have a bowling alley, things that they can do over the weekends, like things that they could take their families to. And that's not, it's no longer there. So you have to drive about 45 minutes or so to the next county, which would be Spartanburg for Union, or Clinton, or Lawrence, and, you know, travel there. So like trying to have things in the city or in the town that would kind of keep them there, and also a livable wage that they can work with and, you know, want to stay.
Mm-hmm. The recommendations start on page 104 of the full report, and really kind of break down, there's probably more here than we can get into with all of them, but it feels like it kind of touched on some of the stuff that Winston was bringing up there in your question about what people can do. So there's several pages in the back that lift up some things that everyone can do, from things like listening to and believing LGBTQ people regarding their healthcare needs to some more specific things there. And then also breaks down recommendations for healthcare facilities and institutions. There's recommendations for healthcare providers, medical support staff, and administrative staff. Recommendations for medical training institutions, mental health providers. So really just LGBT advocacy organizations and funders. But I think just the point is that there's something that all of us can do. I think a lot of times we feel like, well, there's not, I hear that there are a lot of disparities here, but what does that mean for me? Mm-hmm. And there's not really anything that I can do about that. And we take a kind of different approach to that, that we think that everybody has a really vital role to play in changing this culture. Resource deprivation.
That's great. Thank you for that. And there's some other differences here when it comes to male, female, and also income. Do you want to, and race is a very big one as well. Do you want to speak to that?
Yeah. Well, I think that when we look at, with every, intersecting identity that a person has that's marginalized. So if somebody is queer, then they're also trans, and then they're also black or brown, and then they also are living in poverty, and they're also uninsured. We see those things compound exponentially in the barriers that they face and also how they feel about their health outcomes. So when we look specifically at like income, for example, respondents who brought in over 150,000 or 150,000 or more, surprisingly, 90% of them reported that their healthcare was good or excellent, regardless of the fact that they were LGBT. But then when we look at folks who brought in less than 15,000, 41% of them rated their health as fair or poor. Mm-hmm. So I think that that speaks volumes in and of itself as to how greatly your access to resources impact your health outcomes, and all of these marginalized identities, how many of them you possess, whether you're from a rural area even, all of those are going to impact your health outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, I would just like to kind of touch on like the income part, especially just it is, I don't know if there's been a survey on it, but we can just tell amongst our community how it is when you are able to support yourself and also able to have, and I hate to say this, but like a budget for your physical health, because we know that especially in the trans community, that with having low income, we have to budget very, very well. And 9 times out of 10, the physical health component can't even be looked at because you're just trying to find, you know, your rent money or your gas money, your food money. And so then health becomes like, becomes on the back burner no matter what. And even speaking to the point of like not being insured, that's an out-of-pocket cost that most of our community just can't afford because they're just trying to eat to live mm-hmm. and work to live instead of living to work.
Yeah. We should wrap by mentioning that the Trans Day of Remembrance was also this week. Yeah. And I didn't know if you wanted to let people know a little bit about what that was and have anything to say on that.
There was an event here in Asheville that we supported, and another one in Hendersonville that we did, and then in our role with Gender Vendors, we partnered on a remembrance event in Spartanburg, South Carolina, that was led by trans youth. So it was really cool to see them stepping up in that way. But yeah, I mean, that's another issue that, of course, is inextricably bound to our health is there's an epidemic in our country. Trans women of color, particularly black trans women, are being murdered at epidemic levels. Trans Day of Remembrance, this was the 20th anniversary of it that just happened yesterday, and is a day that we say the names and remember the people that we've lost. And I think that we're also, a lot of folks are shifting into really also talking about the importance of resilience in our community, and also having Trans Day of Resilience events, and saying that we don't want to just be remembered mm-hmm. for our deaths. We're really strong and vibrant, and we're artists, and have a lot of really incredible strengths to lift up and be celebrated while we're still here too.
Great. Wonderful way to end the segment. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And now let's switch gears a little bit, and we'll talk about mental health. How are you all feeling?
Okay, did we do all right?
You did great.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Physical, mental.
Okay, so we're on page.
So here we're talking about mental health. We get into some of the physical violence and then depression, anxiety, suicidal ideation. So there's a lot here, too.
Yep.
Okay. All right. And we're back. You're listening to Asheville FM News Hour. I'm News Team Correspondent KP Whaley. We are switching gears now in this series of the LGBT health survey put out by the Campaign for Southern Equality. We are going to be talking today about mental health and the mental health respondents from the survey. Ivy, do you want to kick us off here in terms of some of the numbers that we saw with mental health issues?
We saw a lot of numbers. the survey report is how many pages? Almost 200. But some of them that stand out to me are really particularly the issues that trans folks reported around mental health. More than half of all respondents, as well as 2/3 of trans respondents and 3/4 of non-binary respondents, rate their mental health as fair or poor. That's huge. Mm-hmm. 75% mm-hmm. of non-binary folks say their mental health is either fair or poor. That's a lot of us. And so there's something in that that feels comforting to me to know that I'm not the only one, but the more dominant feeling in that is how heartbreaking it is that these are issues that almost across ubiquitously our community is dealing with.
Yeah. And with that comes a lot of other problems. So if you're suffering mental health, your anxiety levels are bigger, your suicidal ideation is more strong, and that's kind of what this report has consistently found in that as well, correct?
Yep, definitely. 86% of non-binary respondents said that they've struggled with depression. 80% of trans respondents said the same thing. 54% of respondents overall said they struggle with depression, which is still a very high number, but I'm just really taken aback when I read those numbers of the trans community of 80% for trans folks and 86% for non-binary folks. That's almost all of us who are having issues with depression.
Right. And then so compound that with the fact that large majority of those folks also can't find quality health care. They perhaps aren't in a position where they can afford quality health care. What's the help for them? You know, when it comes to finding mental health services, are there mental health services available?
Some. There are some mental health services available. And if you're a trans person or a non-binary person who's looking for a mental health provider and haven't been able to find one, I strongly encourage you to check out the Trans in the South guide. You may be able to find some resources there that could help. But overall, the systems have really failed us. And that's what I think this data says very loudly and clearly. And what we have seen, and we heard a lot of this also with the Trans Health Focus Group report, which was research that we published last year, is that the importance of the role that grassroots leaders and nonprofit organizations are playing in stepping up and filling those gaps for folks and creating community-led spaces where people are able to get some level of support. Obviously, it's still not enough. We need the systems to change. We need change at a systems level desperately. But also, this isn't a completely bleak picture, and I think that we would be remiss to not mention the really heroic work being done by grassroots leaders across the South to fill these gaps.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah. I'm as a cisgendered white gay man, it's telling that to look at the history of mental health within the gay community, within the LGBTQ community, and I don't mean to relate my experience to a person of color who's trans, but I think it's interesting that, you know, back 20 years ago, 30 years ago, there was this belief that, oh, your mental health is why that you are gay. And we've come a long way, I think, in the last few decades to realize that, no, I have mental health issues because you all can't accept me. And I think that we are now seeing that with the trans community, which I think is interesting. Like, why didn't we learn that 30 years ago?
That's a great question. Yeah, I don't know. But I do think we are starting to see some positive culture shift, too. I mean, you know, obviously there's a lot of really sad stuff that can be lifted up, but also there's positive stuff, too.
Right. I would say that in the community organizing efforts and everything like that, Genderbenders was one of 3 recipients this year for their LGBTQ health equality I think it was called, pledge, and we were granted $10,000 for our annual Camp Gender Benders, which is an intergenerational camp that's put on every year. And this year we were able to have the services of QMED, which is a office based in Atlanta, Georgia, that provides like hormone replacement therapy to those that are seeking that kind of care, and also provided gender marker changes, letters for folks that would like their gender marker changed. So in that, we're seeing that even though this is a disparity in the region, we're also being able to combat that with a partnership like the Gender Benders and Campaign for Southern Equality to help our community access the care that they need.
Mm-hmm. Good time to mention Gender Benders, because you've mentioned a couple of times now, but we haven't actually found out what that is. So you want to tell us a little bit about Gender Benders and what that mission is?
Yeah, well, Gender Benders is a grassroots organization based in upstate South Carolina that is a support and advocacy group for transgender and gender nonconforming folks in the upstate of South Carolina, but also we do southeastern work. So one of our big parts of programming is this Camp GB. That's a 4-day, 3-night, magical, special kind of thing where trans folks and non-binary folks alike are just there loving on each other, caring for one another. You don't find any misgendering of names or pronouns or anything like that. It's just a lot of love, a lot of compassion, a lot of holding space for one another, and strategic work and planning to how we're going to transform the South in mm-hmm. ways that we already have and ways that we can make it better.
I think that camp is a cool example. One, because we can talk more about it because we run the camp.
Great.
But also camp is just one example. There's lots of other examples too, but is a cool example of how grassroots organizations and grassroots leaders are stepping up and filling those gaps. So we've been running summer camp for, this was our 7th year. Doing it, and over the last couple years have just looked at it more and more like, how can we build this out as a pipeline for resource delivery, where we're creating a bubble of trans community for a few days. What can we do to bring the service providers to us and get people an opportunity to build those relationships with providers in a non-clinical setting, which we think goes a long way to have that be a positive experience for everybody, and is definitely something that we saw anecdotally at camp this summer.
Mm-hmm. And I should say, you know, what I said earlier, kind of, I guess I meant by the community or the community at large, because the mental health professional community has really kind of helped considerably with the trans community, correct? I mean, they're supportive and positive. You're finding healthcare providers, mental health care providers in the trans community being supportive.
Largely, yeah. I mean, I don't think that we can say that across the board is true. There's definitely, I mean, like, you know, there's bans, there folks are working on bans around conversion therapy and stuff like that. So, you know, I think that negative side of things is still present, but is getting smaller, and we are seeing more growth of folks who are supportive of our community.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the fact that, I mean, you've focused on the South, but do you think there is a difference between the South and the North? Is there, I mean, there's a larger population of queer people here in the South than elsewhere, and yet we're still seeing some pretty disparaging sort of views on where we're at.
I think it's resources.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, and in my mind of where I think it lands, is that the resource, there's a lot more resources available in the North than there is in the South, and of affirmingness, you know, and clinics and things like that. Like, we have it here, we're growing it here, but I don't think that it's as easy to access.
I think I definitely agree with all that. I think another piece of it in the South that does make it a little bit different here is that our culture is really steeped in this anti-LGBT religion. And we see that really permeate all spheres of life, including access to healthcare. And that stings in a really specific kind of way when that discrimination has this religious stamp of approval on it. And I think that's the kind of stuff that we see here in the South a lot more than you see in other regions of the country. But absolutely, the South is home to more LGBT folks, like proportionally than other regions. There's more than 500,000 trans folks who live in the South. Mm-hmm. And I think it's 35% of LGBT folks nationally live in the South.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. And the ban on conversion therapy, obviously, is something Campaign for Social Inequality has done a lot of work on as well, and we are making progress there. Is there any other work that either you're doing in gender benders or within the campaign to get Southern equality for LGBT folks that you want to mention before we wrap up?
There's a lot of stuff that we're doing, but one of the pieces of work that Winston and I both do a lot of is cultural competency training for primary care providers and mental health providers. So over the last year, we've provided training to over 1,000 medical providers. And so that's something that we're both really passionate about, is making that education more accessible for folks. I can't remember if it was this segment or the last time that we chatted, but we talked a little bit about how the providers that are competent have had to really seek out that education themselves. And I think that that's one of the big barriers in place. I don't think it's necessarily that people don't want to be affirming, that people don't want to treat us. I think that the want is there. They just haven't had access to the education. Oftentimes, not all the time, but oftentimes that's the case. And so that's something we do a lot of work on. If folks want to book a training with us, they can absolutely reach out to either one of us, and we'd be happy to do that.
It's also a very, very interactive training.
We have a lot of fun.
We do. I like to consider us almost like game show hosts a little bit. Mm-hmm. So, and I think that's, a key and fundamental thing of like learning is to make it engaging and in some way of the definition of fun, because you retain more. And that's, I think that's kind of like a lot of what we're trying to get folks to understand, like just retain the fact that we're people and we deserve affirming and quality care just as much as our cis counterparts.
Mm. Well, thank you both so much for the work that you do and for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having us.